Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. The Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcast at home is quite easy. You just need a shortwave radio with a schedule of English language broadcast or a computer with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's outfarpress.com, you can listen to the past 5 shortwave reports, find advice for listening to shortwave at home, and find internet links for global news sources. Please check it out and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from Spanish National Radio, Russia Sputnik Radio, and Radio Havana Cuba. We'll begin with Radio Exterior de España, or Spanish National Radio. Allison Hughes reports on the U.S. airstrikes on Hezbollah militia bases in Iraq and Syria. The deadly bombings took place last Sunday as a retaliation for earlier rocket fire on an Iraqi military base that killed a U.S. defense contractor. The U.S. blamed Iran for the original rocket attack, and politicians and thousands of Iraqi protesters became outraged and stormed the U.S. embassy. Iran has denied any links to the attack. The U.S. bombings in Syria were at a base that Hezbollah has used in its ongoing war against fundamentalist Sunni militia and ISIS. In Iraq, demonstrations against government corruption have been going on for months, with many killed and 25,000 wounded, and an Iranian consulate in Iraq was overtaken by protesters. Last Friday, Iran joined China and Russia in joint naval drills in the Gulf of Oman. Saudi Arabia became the largest arms purchaser in the world between 2014 and 2018, with the U.S. supplying 88% of its new weapons. Spanish National Radio.
The U.S. airstrikes on 3 Qataid Hezbollah militia bases in Iraq and 2 in Syria on Sunday have produced outrage among politicians and protesters in Iraq. On Tuesday, as we report, thousands of protesters in Iraq have stormed and set fire to a security post at the entrance to the U.S. embassy compound in Baghdad. The U.S. ambassador to Iraq and other staff were evacuated earlier. Guards at the embassy fired tear gas and stun grenades at the protesters in an attempt to disperse them. Thousands of protesters gathered at the embassy to condemn the U.S. airstrikes on Sunday against the militia bases in Iraq, in which at least 25 people were killed and 55 wounded. On Sunday, the U.S. bombed 3 militia bases in Iraq and another 2 in Syria belonging to the Qataid Hezbollah group. The Iraqi president, as well as the acting prime minister, Abdel Abdul Mahdi, also condemned the U.S. attack, calling it a violation of Iraq's sovereignty. The acting prime minister also suggested that his country would now have to review its relationship with the United States. President Saleh said the strikes violated existing security agreements between the U.S. and Iraq. Both officials were informed of the U.S. bombardments just 1.5 hour before they occurred and had objected to the action but could not prevent it. Sunday's U.S. airstrikes targeted the Qataid Hezbollah militia in retaliation for earlier rocket fire on bases in Iraq which killed an American contractor. U.S. President Donald Trump blamed Iran, tweeting, "Iran killed an American contractor, wounding many." Iran has denied any responsibility for attacks on bases where U.S. forces are deployed in Iraq. Reuters comments the U.S. strikes could pull Iraq further into the heart of a proxy conflict between the U.S. and Iran. Professor Juan Cole writes in informed comment, "Although U.S. Secretary of Defense Mark Esper and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo spoke of the group, Qataib Hezbollah, as being Iran-backed, Iranian President Hassan Rouhani disavowed any Iranian responsibility for the actions of Shiite militia in Iraq. Iran's stated position is that arms must be in the hands of formal Iraqi security forces and that the militia must not challenge Iraqi government authority, but should rather be integrated into state security forces. The Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps has, however, trained and supported several militia. The U.S. also hit two bases of the organization in Syria, attempting to destroy munitions stockpiles. Kataib Hezbollah in Syria has been fighting fundamentalist Sunni militia, some of them tied to al-Qaeda, and also fought against ISIS. Professor Juan Cole adds, "It is a little hard to understand the U.S. strikes on them in Syria, unless the Trump administration is now backing the Sunni fundamentalists." Demonstrations against the Iraqi government began on October 1st, and the protests against unemployment, a lack of public investment in infrastructure, schools, hospitals, highways, and against corruption became massive after a violent response from security forces. Snipers fired on unarmed protesters, paramilitary squads attacked television stations, and invaded hospitals where injured demonstrators were being treated. In the 3 months of protests, more than 460 people have been killed and some 25,000 wounded. The government of Prime Minister Abdul Mahdi has been forced to resign. In the last week in November, protesters set fire to an Iranian consulate, allowing the staff there to leave unharmed and replacing an Iranian flag with an Iraqi one. Most of the protesters come from Iraq's majority Shiite population. As Patrick Coburn wrote for The Independent at the time, "The burning of the Iranian consulate in the holy city of Najaf is particularly significant because it is the home of the Shia religious authorities, headed by the Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani. Its destruction is a sign that many Iraqi Shia have abandoned any sense of religious solidarity with Iran as a Shia state." Sistani has issued statements calling for government reforms and an end to violence by the security forces, but to no avail. Coburn has repeatedly referred to the anti-government protests in Iraq as a Shiite uprising. Last Friday, Iran, China, and Russia began 4 days of joint naval drills in the northern part of the Indian Ocean and the Gulf of Oman. China's defense ministry spokesman said the exercises would, quote, "deepen exchange and cooperation between the navies of the three countries." The Iranian flotilla admiral said, quote, "The message of this exercise is peace, friendship, and lasting security through cooperation and unity, and its result will be to show that Iran cannot be isolated." Last year, President Donald Trump pulled the United States out of Iran's 2015 nuclear deal with six nations and reimposed crippling sanctions on the country. Tension has arisen not only over Iran's disputed nuclear program, which it says now it can resume, but also over a drone attack on Saudi oil facilities in September, claimed by the Houthi rebels fighting the Saudis in Yemen. However, the U.S. and Saudi Arabia blamed the attack on Iran, which also denies involvement in it. Both Russia and China have good relations with both Iran and Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia became the largest arms purchaser in the world between 2014 and 2018, with the United States supplying 88% of its weapons, followed by Britain, France, and Spain. According to the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, or SIPRI, arms deliveries to Saudi Arabia in the period between 2014 and 2018 included 56 combat aircraft from the U.S. and 38 from the United Kingdom. In both cases, the aircraft were equipped with cruise missiles and other guided weapons. Planned deliveries for the 2019 to 2023 period include 98 combat aircraft, 7 missile defense systems, and 83 tanks from the U.S., 737 armored vehicles from Canada, 5 frigates from Spain, and short-range ballistic missiles from Ukraine.
Those reports were by Allison Hughes on Radio Exterior de España or Spanish National Radio. Spain may be heard at their website rtve.es and by podcast as REE. In the 23 years I have produced this show, I have not put together a year in review special. Most international broadcasters do them annually, and I found that a review of some top stories was more important this year than usual. The current media pace is encouraging forgetfulness. So first, from Sputnik Radio, we will hear a few excerpts from George Galloway and his partner Gayatri on his weekly program Sputnik Orbiting the World. The first review is with former MP Chris Williamson, covering the attempted coup in Venezuela. Then the continuing Yellow Vest protest in France with Vanessa Beely. Finally, Vaughn Smith talks about the case of Julian Assange and what his case implies about the state of media in the current era. Russia's Sputnik Radio.
Welcome back to Sputnik, orbiting the year that was 2019. Internationally, the story hitting the headlines at the beginning of the year was the attempted coup in Venezuela, which seemed to overshadow all other news, including coverage from Sudan, Yemen, Syria, Iran, France.
We tried to give an alternative narrative to the mainstream media, but for Trump, the temptation to pick the low-hanging fruit seemed too irresistible for the administration. We invited Chris Williamson into the studio to give his take.
It's almost a carbon copy of what they did to Allende's government. Try to turn the people against and manufacture the shortages. Let's remember what Richard Nixon said. He wanted to make the Chilean economy scream. And that's precisely what they're doing in Venezuela right now. And the sanctions, latest sanctions, make it almost impossible, really, for Venezuela to escape from their economic woes. And we, I think, therefore need to be calling that out, I think. And, when you sit in Parliament and you hear these hawks completely misrepresenting the situation in Venezuela, sadly, on both sides of the chamber, I think it brings democracy into disrepute. It doesn't serve anybody's interests other than the, wealthy elites and the faceless corporations. But it's certainly not in Britain's interest, I don't think, to be supporting Donald Trump in this way. And it certainly won't be if we end up, in a bloody war there. And as far as the situation on the ground for the Venezuelan people, if we're really concerned about the welfare of Venezuelan people, if we were genuinely concerned about human rights and democracy, well, we wouldn't be supporting these sanctions. We wouldn't be beating the drums of war, which is going to lead to a humanitarian catastrophe. And let's also remember what the UN Special Rapporteur said about the US sanctions. He said that they are illegal and could constitute crimes against humanity. And that's the United Nations saying this.
Yeah. Here's a question for you. Can anyone remember what Juan Guaido looks like? He's the person we all recognize as the legitimate president of Venezuela. I even gave him gold bars from the Bank of England and sovereign wealth funds all over the world. 100 countries, I think, recognize him as president.
Yeah.
He's not been seen or heard of, though he is at liberty, wandering around like a lost prophet in Venezuela, calling for the overthrow of a government that is still firmly in place.
From the very visible high-profile coverage to an almost invisible protest, even though they were wearing high-vis vests. Vanessa Beely told us about the news coverage in France, which definitely came from a different angle to Brits Press.
I'm quite encouraged by what a strong independent media there is in France. I mean, Mediapart, if people want to follow French media, Mediapart is doing a very good job of covering it. There are a number of activist sites that are covering it. David Dufresne, who's an independent journalist, if you follow his Twitter feed, he's putting out all of the infractions by the police against the Gilets Jaunes, against civilians protesting, and he's at number 461 now. Hmm. 195 people have been hit in the head, either with mostly with the LBD-40 rubber bullet launcher, which, by the way, has electronic sights, so it's impossible for this not to be an accurate weapon. So it's impossible to say that by mistake they're targeting people in the head, including a volunteer fireman about 3 or 4 weeks ago who was shot in the head as he was walking away and was in an induced coma for 2 or 3 weeks. And he's only just recovering from that. So this is extraordinary brutality that is not being reported, as you said, in the British media. But I think what is happening is that this is a genuine cross-multi-spectrum uprising in France.
The fighting she was talking about there last February is continuing at the end of 2019 on an even escalating curve. The yellow vests are still the core, but the mass trade union ranks of France have joined them. And the firefighter she talked about being hit back in February, well, you can add several hundred firefighters to that. One of the most extraordinary scenes I've ever seen was hundreds of firefighters being attacked by hundreds of police officers. Not something you could imagine happening here.
But the big channel.
It's 29 miles away. And why were we the only people talking about this?
Yeah,
a lot of people in Britain think there's a D notice on this, but there isn't. There's no need for
this
one.
This is the state,
the
right?
Media
this is the state
has,
of the media and
yes,
journalism.
Like Francis Bacon said, self-censorship, it's the arrow that flies in the night. Mm-hmm. You don't see it, but it hits its target. And it has here, 29 miles away, whilst Hong Kong is well over 6,000 miles away. If someone breaks a window in Hong Kong, it's on the television news. Mm. 29 miles away in our closest European neighbour. This has been going on now for over an entire year, every weekend.
And I have to shake people, ask them, have you heard? Did you know? Across the channel. Nope. Well, but they know everything.
Everything
about Hong Kong. And buried even deeper in the media coverage was the arrest, incarceration and trial of Julian Assange. We devoted almost a full show to his good friend Vaughan Smith, who told us about the black propaganda circulating at the time and why we should all be worried about the treatment dished out to him.
I know what's happening. I mean, he delivered, or WikiLeaks did, the INA papers, and these suggest that the Ecuadorian president's family are corrupt. At the same time, Ecuador, by throwing him out of the embassy or inviting the British police to come in and take him out, are breaking international law. That was tested in the Inter-American Court of Human Rights, and the Ecuadorians lost the case against Julian. So they broke international law, and they also got a $4.2 billion loan from the Americans a couple of weeks ago. So I think myself that this is really a smokescreen, and I think it's part of a wider orchestrated campaign to diminish Julian as a person in our eyes, to reduce the public empathy and sympathy for him. And this is very dangerous because actually it's the public that will suffer if Julian is sent off to America. The public will see somebody who's fighting for what they believe in the public interest taken off and made an example of. Because this is vengeance. This is vengeful. It's deeply unpleasant. And it's coordinated. And the Ecuadorian president has come up and said things that don't seem to be challenged properly by journalists. Oh, by the way, the cat's fine. It's with a family member. It's all silly. We're talking about a cat and personal hygiene when there are really important issues about transparency. Julian brought this up 10 years ago. He started the debate on transparency and how governments should be held to account. But we're not talking about that, and it's important, isn't it?
It's been going on for 8 years.
Yeah, I'm almost speechless contemplating Christmas, New Year in Belmarsh prison. Julian has now been disappeared from public view entirely, and indeed even before being taken to prison one could no longer get into the embassy and see him, as you and I did many times in the past. It's utterly heartbreaking, and if people have forgotten about Julian Assange, I hope they watch what Vaughan Smith there had to say, because this man is a martyr to freedom of speech. He's a martyr to what journalism is supposed to be, what whistleblowing is supposed to be, and yet he still faces 157 years incarceration in the dungeons of the United States if he is extradited. And well, if he isn't extradited, he'll spend many years in Belmarsh while it all goes through the different levels of court.
That's if he survives in the first place.
Well,
because you've
many
seen the
doctors
many
think
medical
he's going
reports
to die, yeah.
That he's not going to live longer in this situation. And it has finally occurred to the Australians that actually he should be moved into an Australian prison, where they actually should treat their civilian better.
Well, actually, maybe now that you mention it, maybe that is one tiny bright light on the horizon.
Those excerpts were by George Galloway and Gayatri on Sputnik Radio, the current name for the Voice of Russia, available online at rt.com. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report or could make a donation for production cost of this unfunded program, I may be reached through the website and PayPal or by writing to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. Almost all of the funding this freely distributed program receives is from individual listener donations. In fact, of the more than 100 radio stations rebroadcasting the show this year, only one, WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana, helped to finance it. Please, if you find this program beneficial, help support it like an individual listener in the forest of Branscombe, California, a repeat supporter in Ridgeway, Colorado, and a listener of KDRT in Davis, California, my alma mater, did this week. We will conclude with Radio Havana, Cuba. Here are four parts of their top 10 international news stories of 2019, beginning with political and social unrest in Chile, the coup in Bolivia, an 11-day national strike in Ecuador, and a bit of hope with new leaders in Argentina. Radio Havana, Cuba.
Radio Havana, Cuba, listening to the top 10 international news stories of the past year, 2019. And Radio Havana, Cuba covered Chile this past year, over the past year, 2019. Chile is today the scene of political and social unrest and tensions, which began with mass protests on October the 19th against a subway fare hike in Santiago de Chile. Although the measure was later canceled by President Sebastián Piñera, the demonstrations have grown in size and continue on a daily basis to encompass a number of issues from expensive cost of living, dismal pensions, poor health care, and poor educational services. Protesters are also demanding a new constitution, given that the current Magna Carta was approved in 1980 under the military dictatorship of Augusto Pinochet. The report of the Office of UN High Commissioner for Human Rights says that the national police force, called the Carabineros in Chile, have violently repressed the protests. The report says that the international human rights norms have been violated by both police and army personnel and should be prosecuted. A 30-page document based on research during the first 3 weeks of November extensively details multiple allegations, including torture, rape, and other forms of sexual violence by the Carabineros against people held in detention. The result of the repression: more than 350 Chileans have lost sight or suffered serious eye injuries, the result of police and military brutality unleashed against the protesters by the pro-U.S. neoliberal regime in Chile. On November the 10th, Bolivian President Evo Morales was forced to resign by the military after fascist forces commanded by ultra-right-wing entrepreneur Luis Fernando Camacho, El Macho, the native of Department of Santa Cruz, unleashed violence against the country's predominantly indigenous population. The coup was based on a presumed electoral fraud in the November 20th presidential elections, a totally false argument disseminated by the Organization of American States and the United States. The ousted president first obtained asylum in Mexico, later in Argentina. In both countries, he has never stopped denouncing the gross manipulation of the Bolivian elections by the OAS and its Secretary General, Luis Almagro. Right after Evo Morales' forced resignation, opposition Senator Jeanine Añez proclaimed herself as interim president, swore herself in, thus installing a de facto government with the military's backing. An until then totally unknown politician, whose party, Bolivia Dice No, had received only 4% of the vote in the October 20th elections, she became the sworn-in, self-proclaimed president. Critics say that she has presided over a rapid and deadly slide toward authoritarian rule that echoes the worst moments of early 2000 uprisings, the 1988 to 2005 drug war, and the mass detentions that followed military coups in 1980 and 1981. In Bolivia, Evo Morales' own party, the Movement Towards Socialism, MAS, and all other political groups represented in the Legislative Assembly agreed to hold new elections, which will take place in March. Ecuador was struck by an 11-day national strike triggered by President Lenin Moreno's Decree 883, including an increase in fuel prices, more layoffs of public servants, and cutting workers' rights and measures to favor importers, exporters, and the chambers of production. Moreno's package was a keystone of the broad austerity plan required by the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, in order to extend Ecuador a $4.2 billion credit line. Moreno mobilized the armed forces and police to repress the demonstrations. As a result, 7 people were killed, over 1,300 others were injured, and more than 1,000 were arrested. While Decree 883 that triggered the recent mobilizations, the general discontent that reigns in Ecuador has broader and deeper roots since the moment when Lenin Moreno turned his back on the government program by which he was elected as president. Moreno's initial cabinet was replaced by representatives of the Chambers of Commerce and production of the private media, who are imposing their own vision and the sector and class interests in order to reap enormous profits and benefits from the state administration. Argentinians have entrusted new leaders to take the nation out of the recession, the deep poverty in Argentina, electing Alberto Fernandez as president with his running mate, former president Cristina Fernandez, as the vice president. The progressive Front for All party won a landslide victory with over 48% of the vote. Fernandez's victory put an end to the pro-business economic policies of the Macri administration, who promised zero poverty during his electoral campaign, but left office with a plunging peso, an inflation rate that rocketed at a high annual rate of 56%, and the number of people living under the poverty line in Argentina having risen from 29% to 35%. Now, with a new government, the Argentinian people and the people of Latin America are looking forward to a much better and brighter Argentina.
Those reports were from Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuba's web stream worked well this week at their website, radiohc.cu, but their podcast links were not updated. On shortwave, Cuba may be heard from noon to 1 p.m. at 15140, and from 6 p.m. to midnight at either 6000, 6060, 6100, or 6165. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcasts, get a global perspective. You could use a shortwave radio at home. It's simpler than you might think, except for the fact that electronic devices have made it much more difficult. If you use the internet, listening globally is even easier and noise-free. See the links at this program's website. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's www.outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows. Please consider making a safe donation online through PayPal. There's a link at my website, along with a podcast link, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report, which is now in its 23rd year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. The Shortwave Report is produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.